Genesis 21:22 to 22:24, the 24th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 8, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
One in the first part of chapter 22. We're getting towards the end of the narrative about Abraham. Just have to find it. Okay. And these are the last two. We're going to look at two episodes today. We're going to look at the last part of 21, and then we'll look at chapter 22. And these are the last two episodes in the life of Abraham where we see some development in his moral character. He does enter into the narrative after this, but not as a key player. Eventually, I'll get it. Okay. So we'll look at these two episodes, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the whole progression of the development of his character, from chapter 12, where we first see him, up until chapter 22. So chapter 21, verses 22 through 34. Now it came about in that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, "God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me, or with my offspring, or with my posterity. But according to the kindness that I have shown you, you shall show to me, and to the land in which you have sojourned." And Abraham said, "I swear it." But Abraham complained to Abimelech because of the well of water, which the servants of Abimelech had seized. And Abimelech said, "I do not know who has done this thing. Neither did you tell me, nor did I hear of it until today." And Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Then Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What do these seven ewe lambs mean, which you have set by themselves?" And he said, "You shall take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, in order that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well." Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because there the two of them took an oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, arose and returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba. And there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. This incident is with Abimelech, who I presume is the same Abimelech that we met a year ago in chapter 20, I think it is. He is a Philistine, and that causes some difficulties because it is generally assumed, believed by scholars, that the Philistines did not arrive in Palestine until about 12,000 BC. The Philistines were apparently part of this group of peoples called the Sea Peoples. And the Sea Peoples, we don't know a lot about them, but apparently they originated from the Aegean Sea area. And the Aegean Sea area was populated on the west side with Greek people, and on the east side, some other Indo-Europeans, but we don't know exactly what their origins were. But around the Aegean, they shared a culture. And for reasons that are not clear, in about 12,000, they spread out and started invading all around the shores of the Mediterranean. And one of the places that they invaded was Egypt. And according to the Egyptian records, there was a group of these sea peoples that attacked Egypt. They were defeated, and the pharaoh of Egypt settled them on the south coast of Palestine as kind of a guard against peoples coming down from the north into Egypt. Whether that's true or not, it's not clear, but it is clear that there were Philistines, there were these sea peoples that settled on the south coast of Palestine. And one of the main tribes of those peoples was called the Pelashti. And it's from that name Pelashti that we get the name Palestine. So that land came to be known as the land of the Pelashti. And that's where we get Palestine. So scholars say, well, they didn't show up till the 1200 BC. Abraham is living in 1900 BC. There can't be any Philistines there. Well, that's a very confident assertion on the basis of very little evidence. We don't know for sure that the Philistines were not there earlier. It could very well be that an earlier group of these sea peoples made their way to the south Palestine coast and became and were the Philistines, become known as the Philistines. This is one of those cases where it seems to me that scholars think they know more than they have evidence to base their knowledge on. They speak with too great a confidence. History can be very complicated. And this situation of the settlement of the Philistines in South Palestine, I suspect, is one of those complicated situations in which there were people who made their way to South Palestine long before 1200. In any case, the text says that these are the Philistines that Abraham is dealing with. So the king of this group of Philistines, the king of Gerar, it doesn't say it here that he's the king of Gerar, but it does in the previous passage, is Abimelech, and he comes to talk to Abraham. Now, it's a little difficult to know what kind of person this Abimelech is, because there are a couple of complications. Abimelech shows up in three incidents here in Genesis. In the previous incident, it was when Abraham first came into the land of the Philistines, and Abimelech, the king of Gerar, took Sarah and made her a part of his harem. But God came to him in a dream and said, "You're a dead man if you touch that woman." And Abimelech's response was, "I'm innocent. I didn't know. I didn't know it was his wife. He said it was his daughter, or his sister. He said it was his sister. I didn't know it was his wife. I'm innocent." And God says, "I know that you didn't know. Let the woman go." And he does. In this episode now, Abimelech comes to Abraham and he wants to make this covenant. There is an issue that arises that Abraham is the one who brings up, and that is this problem with the well. And Abraham says, "Your servants have taken over my well." And Abimelech says, "I never heard anything about it. I didn't know that happened. Today is the first day I've ever heard anything about it. You never said anything." And then agrees to make things right. In the third episode, it's one that we have yet to come to. It's with Isaac. And in that instance, one part of that incident is Philistines have been filling in Isaac's wells and driving him further and further away from Gerar. And Isaac says that Isaac holds Abimelech responsible for that and says, you're driving me away. You hate me. Okay. So those are the three incidents that we have. It is argued that Abimelech might be just a title and those are not all the same person. But I think one can see a thread going through them that accounts for the behavior in each case. And I think we have a consistent character. My assumption is that it's one person that we're really dealing with. What kind of person is that? He's a person who is always innocent. If you notice in every account, when he is accused of wrongdoing, it's always, I didn't do it. I'm innocent. He's very quick to defend himself and assert his innocence on the one hand. But on the other hand, he's kind of a snake in the grass. Behind the scenes, he's working. Behind the scenes, he's doing things that are contrary to what he has publicly and personally said that he would do. There is a slight indication in this text that he probably knew that the wells had been filled in, depending on how you take the grammar at one point. In any case, he's the king, and he probably knows what his servants are doing. He probably is aware that his servants have seized the well. In the next instance with Isaac, Isaac clearly holds him responsible for driving Isaac's shepherds away from the wells. So I think he's kind of a snake in the grass. He's in personal interaction, he's very conciliatory and he's innocent. But behind everybody's backs, he's acting differently. So I think that's the kind of character that we're dealing with. In any case, Abimelech comes with his military commander, Phicol. Clearly, they want to make a military treaty, or a treaty with military significance, with Abraham. Now, it's important to understand what kind of place Palestine is at this time. There is no one king in control of Palestine. There are no world powers that have control of Palestine. There are some world powers. There are some large empires in the world at this time. In Mesopotamia, there are some large, very large kingdoms and powerful kingdoms. And Egypt is a powerful kingdom at this time. Palestine's in the middle. And no world power has control of Palestine. So it's divided up into little entities, city-states, and tribal chieftains. And they are in constant conflict one with another. So Abimelech, he is interested in allying himself with anyone that might be helpful in these constant skirmishes that are going on between the peoples of Palestine. And he looks at Abraham and he says, there's someone who could be an ally. Now, Abraham is not a power broker. It's Abraham, his household, but he doesn't have a kingdom. He's not a large power broker. We saw earlier that Abraham was able to put together an army of about 320 men, I believe it is, from his household to attack the kings of the east who had come from the east and had gone through Palestine, had captured Lot, if you'll recall, his nephew, were taking Lot back to Mesopotamia, and Abraham was able to put together an army of 300-some men from his household and get some allies, go attack them and free Lot. So he's not completely without significance as a military power, but he's not a power broker. Nevertheless, Abimelech would like to have him on his side. Now, Abimelech has seen that Abraham is blessed by God. And that's significant to Abimelech. Now, God had said when he came to Abraham that he was going to bless Abraham. And God has indeed blessed Abraham. But what is the nature of that blessing? Ultimately, and most significantly, I think the nature of the blessing that God placed on Abraham is he opened Abraham's eyes and his ears and helped Abraham to see what is the nature of our existence here in this life and the importance of being obedient to God. That is to say, that in this life, there's nothing of eternal significance. We are just passing through in this life. So what is there of significance? What is there of eternal significance? The only thing there is of eternal significance is righteousness, is trusting in God and living according to his principles. That is a gift from God. That is a true blessing. And that's what God has done, opened his eyes and his ears and helped him to see reality clearly. I think that's ultimately the most significant blessing that God has placed on Abraham. He has also given him a number of promises. Promises with eternal consequences. And those are significant. That's a significant blessing as well. But Abimelech can't see those things. Someone without the eyes to see cannot see those things. God also happened to bless Abraham in a different way. And that is, God gave Abraham wealth and, to a certain extent, power in this life. God has been Abraham's shield. He said, I will be your shield. And Abimelech has seen that firsthand because God came to Abimelech in a dream and said, you're a dead man if you touch that woman. That's something Abimelech can understand. That's a blessing that that Abimelech can identify with. And I think that is what Abimelech is responding to. Abraham is a man of wealth and power. Abraham has God on his side. And Abimelech wants to be allied with someone who has God on his side. So, Abimelech comes to Abraham, wants to form a treaty. And what he says is, you don't deal falsely with me, and you be good to me and my descendants as I have been good to you. Now, I think when he says, you will not deal falsely with me, he's hearkening back to the incident earlier when Abraham had said, when he first arrived in the land of the Philistines, he had said that Sarah was his sister. Well, that was true, but it wasn't the whole truth. Sarah is Abraham's wife, and Abraham failed to mention that. So from Abimelech's perspective, Abraham has dealt falsely with him once. And he's saying, let us make an agreement. You don't deal falsely with me, and let's have an ongoing commitment to treat each other kindly. Abraham readily agrees to such an arrangement. This is fine with him. Even though Abimelech is a bit of a snake in the grass, still he jumps at this opportunity to make such a covenant with Abimelech. However, he raises at this point the issue of water rights. But there is this, I agree to make this ongoing commitment to you and your descendants. But there is a source of friction between us, and we need to face into this. And that is, we're living in the desert, and water is extremely important. I dug a well, and your servants have seized that well. And that is a source of potential ongoing friction between us. And Abimelech says, I didn't know anything about it. Abimelech's response here, I think, is overdone. I think that this is, he does know what had happened. And I think that's the way that we are to understand this. In any case, Abraham's perspective is, we'll settle this here and now. So there are two different covenants that are reached here and sealed with these gifts of animals. The first one is a covenant that they will have between Abimelech and his descendants and Abraham and his descendants. There will be an ongoing peace treaty. And that peace treaty is sealed by Abraham giving a gift of oxen and sheep to Abimelech. But there's also a sub-treaty to this, and that is the well that Abraham dug, that will be his well. And to seal that part of the agreement, Abraham gives to Abimelech an additional 7 ewe lambs. Okay, so those are the agreements that are made, and Abraham is... Oh, and then Abimelech goes home, he and his commander. Abraham is apparently thrilled with this arrangement. This is something worthy of celebrating and commemorating. He names the well of seven. Beersheba means well of seven. But the word for seven is closely related to the word for oath. So is it it's the well of seven or the well of the oath, with kind of a play on words. But this is something worth celebrating. He names the well. He plants a tree in commemoration of this event. And he gives praise to God for bringing this about. Why the celebration? I think this is because if you look back at Abraham's life, he has been very itinerant, moving from one place to another. Why has he moved so often? Well, one of the reasons was famine. That's why he went down to Egypt, if I'm not mistaken. But the other reason is this is a very unsettled place. It's a place where there's a lot of danger. And he's moving around trying to find a place where he can settle in and have some peace. And here in Beersheba, he has found a place in the desert where he can be fairly secure. The local power broker has agreed to a peace treaty with Abraham. So he can settle in here and call this place home. And I think this is a celebration in recognition of that fact. This is interesting because the security that's being provided here is pretty flimsy, really. I mean, Abimelech, I don't think we are to see Abimelech as a trustworthy individual. Nevertheless, there's a little bit of security here, at least for the time being. He's on good terms with the only other significant power in the area. So God has provided a little bit of security, which seems to me very God-like, that throughout our time in this world, much of our life is spent struggling in one way or another. Oftentimes it's inner struggles of one sort or another. There are always problems pressing in on us, sometimes much more severely, and other times they kind of abate. And there are times in our lives when we achieve a certain amount of peace from those struggles. But it's always a tenuous peace. It's always just a resting place, and one that we will always move on from. Because in this world, we will never have that kind of peace where we can really settle down and put in our roots. So Abraham has found this place. It's just a tentative resting place, a little bit of security in this life of insecurity, because his real rest is yet to come. It's not in this life. He ends up living out the rest of his days in Beersheba. Isaac spends much of his life in Beersheba. So it is indeed a resting place, relatively speaking, for them. Okay. The next incident is one of the most famous passages of the Old Testament, chapter 22, where God tells Abraham to offer up his son Isaac. I'll read verses 1 through 19. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide," as it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. This is the last of the recorded acts of Abraham in which we see him developing as a as a moral person. And it's interesting that there are similarities between this incident and the way it's recorded and the incident in chapter 12 when God first comes to Abraham. Just let me point out a few of the similarities. Both of them, God comes to Abraham and says, go forth. Earlier, Abraham was told to go forth from the land where he was living, and here he's to go forth from Beersheba. In both instances, he's told to go to some place that's not designated. It's a place that God will show him. In both places, he is supposed to give up something that is dear to him. And the dearness of the thing that he's to give up is stressed in the narrative. If we look back at chapter 12, verse 1, it says, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. So in three ways it describes this thing that's dear to him, that he is being asked to leave. Here it says, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. So three expressions indicating how dear the son is to him that he is supposed to put to death. And in both cases, at the end of the episode, Abraham is blessed. In both cases, he worships on an altar at the end. And in both cases, a genealogy follows after the episode. So I think the author has intentionally made chapter 12 and chapter 2 kind of like the bookends that hold the tomes of Abraham's life. And we see between it the development that he has gone through, the full development. So we see in chapter 22 then the culmination of this activity that God has carried out in Abraham's life and the change that's taken place. The narrative starts out by saying that this is a test. So we as the readers have been informed early on that this episode has been orchestrated by God for a very specific purpose. And I think that it is a hint that the slaying may not actually take place. In any case, this is something out of the ordinary. We are not to see this as something that is standard, fortunately. This is something very out of the ordinary. This is a singular event. God has spoken to Abraham several times in the past, sometimes directly, sometimes through an angel. In this instance, he speaks to him without an intermediary. It's directly. There's no mention of an angel. And in order to understand this episode, I think it has to be the case that there is no question in Abraham's mind but what God told him to do this. If I were in his place and God spoke to me and said, take your only son and slay him and present him as a burnt offering, I know what I'd be thinking. I know what would happen. For the next 3 days, I'd be saying, that's not really what he said. It wasn't really God. I was just imagining it. It was just a dream. I would try to find any way possible to explain it away. But there must be something unique about this situation in which Abraham has no question but what, one, it was God that spoke, and two, that he knows exactly what God said to do. There's no ambiguity whatsoever. Now, I've heard Jack in the past suggest that there must be something about when God speaks to someone like Abraham that there's no question that it is God speaking and not just thoughts that come into my mind. It has to, in some way, be distinctive and stand out, be something that's not part of our ordinary experience. There is no question about it. And in order to understand this passage, I think that has to be the case here. Okay, what is the nature of the test? Think about this a little bit. As we've gone through talking about Abraham's life, and you'll have to be remembering back to last year for part of it. But Isaac was a miracle child. Isaac was promised to Abraham when Abraham was 75 years old. And there were lots of things that happened, lots of twists and turns in Abraham's life before Isaac was finally born. But Isaac was not born until Abraham was about 100 years old. Now Isaac is grown. It's not clear how old Isaac is, but he's old enough to carry wood on his shoulder. He's old enough to understand what's going on. He's got to be 10 or so, and probably quite likely older. He could be 20 years old, so he's someplace in that range. Abraham's at least 110 years old now. Abraham has been living with this promise of an heir since Abraham was 75 years old. So he's lived with this promise a long time. This promise has been reiterated a number of times by God. And Abraham has come to really believe that it is true. In fact, Isaac's birth was a miracle. Isaac was born to his 90-year-old mother, after she had never had any children before. And it is highly likely, it seems to me, that Abraham, the whole world is in his son. This is the thing that he had hoped for. Now it has come. That he is the one that's going to inherit the promises. And in that culture, your oldest son was extremely important to carry on your posterity. So Isaac is everything to him, and God is saying, take him and slay him. In other words, will you give up Isaac out of obedience to me? Which is more important? What a horrible, horrible situation to be in. I mean, if you think about it at all, it's a horrible situation to be placed in, and yet that's the situation in which he was placed. And the question is, can God be trusted? He is told to go, then, to start out, take his son, and go to the land of Moriah, to a place that God is going to show him. Now, the etymology of this term Moriah is not clear. It is apparently related to the word to see, but there are several different possible meanings for the name. But in any case, it apparently is a well-known location, and apparently it's a location that in which sacrifices or worship was carried out regularly. And there's even an implication in the text that there may be an altar there that Abraham is supposed to rebuild, because it refers to it as the altar. It's a 3-day journey from Beersheba, apparently. So if we put all these clues together, plus the fact that this name does occur one other time in the Old Testament, and that's in 1 Corinthians 3:1. And there it indicates that this is the place on which Solomon built the temple. So if we take that at face value, this place to which Abraham is supposed to go is the place later where the temple is built and sacrifices were made on a regular basis. And it's also the place where eventually Jesus would be put to death on Calvary, which is right next to it. He rises early. Now, last time we noticed that he rose early. He got up early when he was sending Ishmael off into the desert. And I indicated that I thought that was because he was eager to do what was right. And Tony mentioned to me afterwards that he thought that the real reason is because he couldn't sleep. He has so much anxiety. And I think that's right. That's really what I meant. He's so anxious that he wants to get this underway and get out of the way. So he gets up early, he makes all of the arrangements, and he sets off with two servants, which it was customary for men of significance to have two servants who would accompany them, and Isaac. And they take off, head off on this three-day journey. And it's 3 days. Those must have been the most agonizing 3 days of his life. I mean, if you imagine it, he's going, if God had come to him and said, run out right now, out of your tent, and slay your son, that would be one thing. Because you could kind of screw up your courage and then not think about it and just run out and get it done with. That's not the situation here. It's a three-day hike. That means he can't just screw up his courage once and go out and do it. He has to keep making the decision minute by minute. No, we're doing this thing. I'm going to do what I was asked to do. So for 3 days, he has to keep making the same decision. No, I'm going to do what God asked me to do. And he's got three people with him, but one of the things that struck me as I was reading this and studying it is there are three people with him, but this is a lonely trip because none of the rest of them share in this, in the knowledge of what it is that he has to do. He's the one agonizing over this thing. They are not agonizing over it. Because they don't know what's happening. Now, in saying that about his mindset, I'm making an assumption, and I think it's an important assumption. And it's one that I feel increasingly comfortable with when I look at Old Testament narratives. It doesn't tell you what's going on in Abraham's mind. We have none of the inner thoughts of Abraham recorded in the text. In fact, these Old Testament narratives are really sparse in detail. So how do you make sense of them? Well, the only way that you can make sense of them is you take human experience as we all know it, and you imagine yourself in the shoes of Abraham. We are encouraged to do that. At various places in a historical narrative in the Old Testament, you'll be given clues as to how someone is responding to something. But it's just a brief clue, and once you get that clue, then you know what kind of experience you're supposed to read into it. In this case, I think we are encouraged to not see Abraham as being in a zombie state as he's going to do this thing. He's not dispassionate. He isn't just this soldier of faith who has no thoughts about whether he should do this or not. He's wrestling with this for 3 days. And I think we're encouraged to see it that way. I know that's what I would do. I'd be wrestling the whole time. Okay. They arrive at the area where the slaying is supposed to take place. And Abraham says, he tells the two men, we are going up to the mount. You stay here with the donkey. We are going up to the mount to worship, and then we will return. I think that we are to see those as that is a significant statement on Abraham's part. He means it. He means that they are going to go up and worship and that both of them are going to return. Having thought it through, Abraham is convinced that Isaac was indeed promised to him by God. Isaac is the one who will inherit the promises that were made to Abraham. And in order for those promises to come true, Isaac has to continue to live. So, if God has told him to kill Isaac, then somehow Isaac is going to continue to live, even if he has to come back from the grave. In Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says in chapter 11, verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendants. Figure is, even if it takes a miracle to bring him back to life, that's what God will do. God can be trusted in his promises, and therefore I can do what God has asked me to do. So the two of them take off, and twice in the narrative it says the two of them go together, Isaac and Abraham. Well, Isaac turns to Abraham with the horrible question. Isaac says, where's the offering? I mean, we've got the wood, we've got the fire, we've got the knife. Where's the offering? And that question had to be a really piercing question. I mean, I can almost feel the pit of my stomach when you hear when Isaac asks it. Abraham's response is, God will provide. And I think that's a meaningful response. Abraham truly believes that. That I don't know how this is going to play out. All I know is the promises that have been made. And all I know is the character of the God that I serve. And somehow, some way, God will provide. They arrive at the mount, the top of the mount. Abraham binds Isaac. Now, we aren't given details. I would love to have more details. Did Isaac fight him? Did Abraham explain to him the situation? Did Isaac understand it and embrace this as well and say, okay, tie me up? I don't know. It doesn't say. We don't have those details. I would assume that Isaac actually cooperates here. That Isaac too is taking the perspective, if this is what God has asked be done, then I'm on board. In any case, Abraham binds him, places him on the altar, raises the knife and is ready to kill him. And at that moment, at the last moment, God intervenes and says, Abraham, stop. And God says, now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So Abraham had passed the test. Abraham had come to the point where he was willing to put to death his only son out of obedience to God. Then Abraham looks around and there's a ram with its horns caught in a bush, and they take the ram and they place the ram on the altar in the place of Isaac and offer it up as a sacrifice. So God did provide the sacrifice just as Abraham had said he would, and spared Isaac. Then God swore by himself, which is the most holy of oaths. He swears by himself that he will bless Abraham, and he repeats many of the blessings, many of the terms of what he had said that he would do for Abraham and his posterity. Then indeed Abraham and Isaac go back down the mountain, as Abraham had said they would. They pack up, they go back to Beersheba and continue their life in Beersheba. There are a couple of things that I think are significant in this story. The first one is to ask this question: how did Abraham get to this place where he was obedient to the point of being willing to take the life of his most valuable thing in this world? Well, God had created faith in Abraham over a long period of time. We're talking about 35 years. And the narrative in Genesis gives us some of the key incidents in that life, but I'm sure there were many, many more. There were 35 years worth of episodes in which God is dealing with Abraham. He led him out of Mesopotamia into a wild land, into Canaan. He took care of him there in Canaan. He blessed him and said that he would make him a great nation, and that he would bless him and make his name great. On two different occasions, he saved Sarah from being incorporated into the harem of one of the local rulers. He gave Abraham the spirit of generosity to enable him to allow Lot to choose first from the land which they would settle in order to avoid conflict between relatives. He had promised him a son. He had promised that Isaac would come along. It took a long time for it to happen, but it did indeed come to pass. A son through Isaac, through Sarah, as he had said it would. There would be. He promised him the land of Palestine. He spared him the corruption and the destruction in Sodom and Gomorrah. And as it turned out, the bad land that he got stuck with when Lot chose first ended up in the long run being the better of the land because he was spared the moral corruption. And he gave him the son Isaac through his elderly wife, Sarah, the miraculous birth of the son. So this has been a 35-year curriculum that God has put Abraham through, in which Abraham learned that God could be trusted in his promises, and therefore he was free to obey this God who had been so good to him. What's interesting is that on the one hand, faith is a miraculous work of God, something that he just reaches in and does in our hearts. But on the other hand, it's a long, slow process in which we do a lot of struggling and wrestling. And I think it is inevitably so. If you look at the people of faith in the Bible, whenever we have enough detail to flesh it out, it's always a process that people go through. Faith comes over a long period of time, slowly and piece by piece. There are no shortcuts. There is only this wrestling that goes on constantly. There are many late nights. There are many tears. And there are many agonizing moments. And in that sense, I think Abraham is kind of an everyman That's true for all of us. Faith is hard fought. It's hard earned, in a sense. It's a gift of God on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's hard earned. And it took Abraham 35 years. We can't expect it to take any less time for us. The other thing that's striking here is that the life of faith is ultimately very lonely. As I was studying this passage, the thing that jumped out at me is how lonely this chapter is. Notice there's no mention of Sarah. She isn't mentioned once in here. I don't know if Abraham told Sarah what he was going to do or not. It seems to me it's quite possible that he didn't even tell her. Because there's no decision to be made. He has to do it. To tell her is just laying a burden on her, anxiety on her. He may have just decided, I'm not going to do it. But we don't know. The narrative doesn't say. And I think the narrative doesn't say because we are encouraged to look at Abraham. And this is a struggle that's going on inside of Abraham and between him and God. He doesn't even ask anybody to pray for him. He doesn't tell Isaac what he's doing. He doesn't tell the two men what he's doing. This is between him and God, a wrestling match in his soul. And I think that what we are supposed to see is that, I mean, it's true that there are a lot of things that other people can do to help us. They can give us moral support. They can give us encouragement. That's all very good and helpful. It's wonderful on the one hand. But on the other hand, it's ultimately between me and God. And nothing can be done to change that. Ultimately, I have to work it out between me and God. And here we see Abraham. He's working this out between him and God. And I think the narrative is really encouraging us to see it that way. That whatever help other people might provide, Abraham understands that he's the one in this particular situation that has to do the heavy lifting. I know that whenever I get in a tough spot, my inclination is to think, who could help me? Who could help me out of this? And sometimes people can help us. But there are other things no one can help you with. And this is one of those situations. And I think this is true of all of us. It's just much of life is this ceaseless wrestling match, where we're wrestling ourselves and we're wrestling with God. Much of the most important things that happen in life are that internal struggle that happens inside of us. That's not to say that what happens outside of us is irrelevant. Clearly, that's not the case. What happens outside of us is very important. But what happens outside of us, to a large extent, is just the material for that inner wrestling match. It provides the context in which those struggles are created that we have to wrestle our way through. So in that sense, the life of faith is a very lonely life. However, God is there. And God is superintending the process. God knows what he's doing. And he's working on us. And everything that happens is a part of that multi-year curriculum that he is putting us through. And he's building faith in us brick by brick. And it takes time. There is no shortcut to that. And he is committed to bringing us through that process and bringing us to the point of faith, just as he did with Abraham. And in every one of those struggles, we can be certain, as was Abraham, that because of who God is, and no matter how impossible a situation might seem, God will provide. One way or another, God will provide. He's making us, he's shaping us, he's forming us, and making us into people of faith who understand what this life is all about, understand what is really valuable, and what we ought to stake our lives on. And to understand that and to really embrace it, just as he did with Abraham. Okay. Questions, comments?
One of the things I've always struggled with this story is, what are we to make of the nature of God that he would require to kill another human being? In other words, he's doing something that's counter to a commandment he would later give. And it wasn't like, go burn your fields so you don't have any food for the following year. It was actually to take the life of not only another human being, but his own son. So I was wondering, what can you make of that in terms of the character of God himself?
Well, I think it's clear that God is inscrutable. God does some really strange things. And it is true that he has commanded Abraham to do something that later he forbids. But I think if God has that prerogative, God can command us to do something that he has prohibited elsewhere, because he has higher purposes. I mean, if I think of myself as a parent, there are times when I tell my children to do things that I have told them at other times they should never do, because it's extraordinary circumstances in which, in general, this thing is not allowed, but in this particular circumstance is justified. And I think in this situation, what he's doing is he's creating a picture. He's creating a picture of a father who has to give up his only son for a very important purpose. It's interesting that he stops him short of actually having to carry it out. But there's another instance in history where it is not stopped short. That goes on, that is carried through, and that's with the death of the son, Jesus Christ. So Abraham, we can identify, by looking at Abraham, we can identify with God's perspective at the time in which Jesus Christ is offered as a sacrifice. And I think that's what we're encouraged to do in this passage. So, can God command something that is contrary to his principles, generally speaking? Yes, he absolutely can. And he commanded it here, but he stops Abraham short from actually carrying it out. Why does he ask him to do this extraordinary thing? Because it creates a picture for something later in history that God wants us to understand. So I think that's what's going on.
Curious, then you get into situational ethics and the whole thought about morality being an inviolable standard. Sounds like this isn't... Can you get from that the gist of where I'm going?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're wondering, doesn't this get us into an ethical nightmare of nothing being fixed? What is fixed? What is fixed is God's perspective on the world and his principles. And we are to live out our lives in conformity with those principles. But those principles always have to be applied to a situation. In that sense, yes, absolutely, they're situational. They have to be situational. But the principles are fixed because they're tied to the character of God. God says, thou shalt not kill. Why shall we not kill? We have not been given the authority to take the life of another human being. We are supposed to have more respect for them than that. That doesn't mean God can't kill. God puts people to death on a daily basis. Why? Because he's God. He can do that. But we are not to kill. But could there come a time when we as human beings would be required by God to put someone to death? Yes. And if God comes to me and says, put someone to death, then I would be obligated to do so. You know, like I've said before, it'd have to be really clear. It would have, I don't know how, it's hard for me to imagine how it could be so clear that that I would know that that's what I'm supposed to do. But if it were clear, I have no choice. So, what is fixed? What is fixed is the character of God and his principles. But how those principles come together in a particular circumstance can be very complicated. So, looking at it that way, it is more tricky than just applying rules. I grant that. But it's more lifelike. Because as a parent, I know that I have told my kids never to do X, and then later have asked them to violate that command to never do X because of an extraordinary circumstance. The example that I have used before is I have told my children never to swing a baseball bat in the house. Why? Because I don't want them to smash stuff. But if there were a fire in the house, I would want them to take a baseball bat and bust out the window and get out. Why? Because there's another principle that kicks in there, that more valuable than the window is their lives. So there's a situation where I have given a command, don't ever swing the baseball bat in the house, and yet I know that there are times when, from my perspective, they should violate that very command. And we have to grant that same kind of flexibility to God. God, you don't apply commands, you apply a worldview. That's what I want my kids to do. I want them to look at any situation through my eyes and do what I would want them to do, not just follow the commands. Because my commands haven't always taken all of the complexity of life into account. And God does the same thing. That means that it's tricky. It's easier to just follow the rules. So this becomes tricky, but it's lifelike. Okay. I think I better stop. Thanks.